When amateur astronomer Jay McNeil discovered a nebula in a photo taken through his backyard telescope one night last January, other astronomers around the world, both amateur and professional, sat up and took notice. In fact, they rushed to their telescopes and photo archives for a look. The nebula was visible in the 60s, although nobody paid much attention to it back then. But now people realize McNeil's nebula had alerted them to a unique opportunity to study a newborn star. The star was providing the light shining off the dust particles in the nebula, and it could be much like our own sun was when it was in its infancy over 5 billion years ago. Joel Kastner set about looking at the X-rays being emitted by that young star, and his findings appear this week in the journal Nature. They could even tell us about the origin of our own solar system. With me now are both discoverer and author, and if you have a question about McNeil's nebula or the X-rays from the star that's lighting it up or anything about early star formation, we'll try to answer it at 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. First, let me introduce Joel Kastner. He's the lead author of the Nature paper and an associate professor of astronomical imaging and spectroscopy at the Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York. Dr. Kastner, welcome to the show.
Pleased to be here.
And Jay McNeil is the discoverer. He's a nighttime amateur astronomer and a daytime satellite TV installer from Paducah, Kentucky. Welcome to Science Friday, Mr. McNeil.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So first, let's start with you, Jay McNeil. Tell us how you came across this nebula of yours.
Well, I was just simply out doing a routine imaging session one night, which my observatory is located in my backyard here, about 30 foot from my back doorstep. So, I mean, just about every clear night of the year, I'm usually out there imaging in one form or another. And it was just a typical routine night. It was very cold, very windy. I didn't spend, didn't devote a whole lot of time to it, to imaging that night because of the weather and everything, and I had to be at work the next morning. So I just decided to test out this new small scope that I'd gotten recently and took a picture of a large swath of sky there in Orion containing several, you know, interesting but brighter nebula. And it wasn't until a couple days later when I went to processing the images that I'd taken that I realized there was something small but yet conspicuous that I'd never noticed there before.
Maybe just so before people ask, what kind of equipment were you using?
Well, the telescope itself was a relatively small telescope, a 3-inch telescope, only 80 millimeters in diameter, the objective, similar to a scope you can buy, as far as the diameter of the optics goes, similar to any scope you can buy at any department store. However, it was a very high-quality refractor made by a company called Takahashi. So it was a what's called an apochromatic refractor, which is a very high-resolution telescope for that size. However, it wasn't so much the telescope as it was the camera. The camera I have is a very nice, very sensitive camera that's especially sensitive toward the infrared part of the spectrum, where the human eye, of course, loses its response.
Right. And when did you realize that you had something pretty interesting?
Well, I got to processing my images, and at first I thought it was just an odd reflection on one of my frames, because my images are composed of multiple smaller exposures that I stack digitally to make a final image with a high signal-to-noise ratio. And I checked a couple more frames, and it was on there also. And I finally went ahead and processed the entire image, and I saw the object was very peculiar, and it was obviously something very real, not a reflection of any sort. So I immediately went online and went on to the NASA online databases, such as I went on SIMBAD and did an area search for that part of the sky, which pulls up every object ever discovered in that part of the sky within a certain radius. And I started downloading archival photos from the Palomar Optical Sky Survey, which is available to the public online. And, you know, none of these images, which were taken through scopes, you know, 48 inches in aperture, a whole lot larger than my scope with you know, real sensitive film back in the 70s and 60s, none of these showed this object, you know, so it was just obvious that it didn't, obviously it wasn't always there.
No, interesting. Well, maybe I can turn to you, Joel Kastner, and ask, when did you learn about this observation, and what did you make of it when you first heard about it?
Well, I must have heard about it in early February, or thereabouts, middle of February, when my colleague here, Michael Richmond, in the physics department at RIT, I'm at the Carlson Center for Imaging Science, and he works downstairs from me, ran into my office excitedly and said, "You got to look at this." And he had downloaded some images. I think they weren't actually Jay McNeil's. They were follow-up images taken after Jay McNeil's. And two of us kind of scratched our heads about it and realized pretty quickly that it was very likely an example of a flaring young young star, as a star in formation. This kind of an occurrence is very rare. We actually catch one of these guys going off and flaring like this. In fact, there have just been a few of these, a handful of these observed in the last few decades.
How did you know it was a young star? What made that the clear explanation?
Well, there are various clues that tell us it's young. It's found in a very dense cloud of gas and dust. Where lots of fairly well-studied young stars are located. That's the biggest clue. And also, it very much resembles the sort of what are called reflection nebulae around other similar young stars.
I see. And so why look at this particular part of the sky in the X-ray? I mean, I said you looked at it with X-ray observations. Why X-ray?
Well, there's a long-standing mystery surrounding X-rays from young stars. It turns out when stars are very young, they emit X-rays at rates relative to the star's light about 1,000 times that of the sun. The origins of that X-ray emission are a bit of a mystery. And when Michael and I looked at this, and with our colleague David Weintraub at Vanderbilt University started to think about it a little bit, we realized that this might be a golden opportunity to shed a little light on the origin of bright X-ray emission from young stars. One of the first things we did actually was to go back and look at the archive of the Chandra X-ray Observatory, which is one of NASA's great observatories. It's on a class with the Hubble Space Telescope, which a lot more people have heard of, I think. Mm-hmm. But Chandra's up there doing great science as well. Today happens to be the fifth anniversary of Chandra's launch. July 23rd, 1999 was the launch. Yeah. So it's been operating for 5 years splendidly, and it turns out that in November of 2002, a team of scientists led by Ted Simon in Hawaii had used Chandra to image the same part of the sky, and there was a very weak but detectable X-ray source at the very position of the star that sits at the foot of J. McNeil's nebula.
So you had something to look at. I have one question before I open the phones to our callers, and go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I should have added one thing, yeah. Joe, which is that we quickly, David and Michael and I quickly let Harvey Tenenbaum, the director of the Chandra X-ray Science Center, know that this brightening had occurred from McNeil's nebula, and we asked for the telescope to point that way. And the staff of the Chandra X-ray Observatory were kind enough to fulfill our request, and so we got a couple of observations of it in March, and watched it and saw that it had gotten brighter by about a factor of 50, to correspond with the brightening that apparently happened in the optical. So that was a very important piece of news for us.
So that's really my question. This brightening is happening in a scale of years or possibly decades, and it's not thousands of years; it's tens of years.
Well, actually, the object brightened in a matter of weeks.
Wow.
You know, after J. McNeil had posted his bulletin about the object getting brighter, or actually, I should say that the nebula appearing where he hadn't seen one before on archival plates, a team led by Cesar Briceño looked back at their images, and they were taking images of the same region using a telescope in Venezuela, I believe. And they caught it on the way up, and you can just watch the nebula growing like a searchlight beam stretching out across space over the course of their images, which were taken over about 4 or 5 weeks, I think.
Interesting. Okay, I promised to open the phones up, and I will do that now. Let's first go to John in Las Vegas, Nevada. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Hi, John.
Hopefully you can hear me on my cell phone, but I had a question. How sure are we that this mechanism of star formation is based on coalescence of raw material, or is there some other theories out there right now?
Okay, I think I heard that the question was the coalescence of raw material for star formation. How sure are we about that? Maybe Joel Kastner could take a stab at that.
Well, as I mentioned before, it's been predicted for a long time that stars should form out of dense clouds of gas and dust in interstellar space that are dense enough that the particles can attract each other and start a sort of a gravitational collapse of material. And that's where objects like McNeil's nebula and the young stars around it are found, in fact, inside one of these dark clouds. So I think You know, as much as we can prove these things, astronomers have proved that stars do form, you know, from the coalescence of material in dense clouds of gas and dust.
I need to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Earl in Philadelphia. Earl, welcome to the program.
Hello, Joe, Jay, and Jeff. This is a really good hour for astro science geeks like myself. There was one little piece of information missing, though. I've been interested in imaging astronomy for a long time, back to the days when you had to build it with your own very own CCDs, maybe swipe from a copier. And my question, let me think, it's Jeff?
No, it's Jay McNeil is the discoverer.
Jay McNeil, yes, yes. You said you had a great camera, and you described it in glowing terms, but you didn't actually say whose it was.
Oh, okay. Well, Jay McNeil, can you divulge that information?
Yes. The camera, it was made by Santa Barbara Instruments Group. It's it's an ST10 XME.
Okay, because I know there's a few really good ones that I can't afford, but I like the idea that somebody's used one for, you know, this research, and it's a guy, you know, put it out in his backyard and did it with a small scope. It's really cool.
Okay.
Great stuff.
All right. Thanks, Earl, very much for the call. Let's go to Alex. Alex in Jacksonville, Florida. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, we got a bit of an echo there. Can you answer your question?
What is the best time to view the nebula?
What is the best time to view the nebula? Okay, I'm going to take you offline and let our guests answer that. Maybe Jay McNeil, is it still visible?
Well, actually, the nebula is located in the constellation of Orion, which happens to be a winter constellation. Now, she says, when is it visible? It's not going to be visible during the summer months, of course, because those constellations are located behind the sun from our point of view. However, during the winter, Orion is up, you know, well high in the sky for mid-northern latitudes. But she wants to know when it's visible, but that's the problem. This object, unless just some really miraculous thing occurs, and this star really brightens extensively, this object, even though I discovered it with a relatively small telescope, I had a very sensitive camera. And the object itself is quite small, but not only that, but it's an extremely faint object visually, because it does lie in an area of the sky that's laden with dust and just obscuring matter. And by nature of the beast, reflection nebulae in general are just specifically not very bright objects compared to other types of deep sky objects visible to the eye through telescopes visually.
So pretty hard to observe.
I have seen it through a 16-inch telescope, and of course there have been reports of people around the globe seeing it when it was at one of its brightest stages back in February with scopes as small as 14.5 inches. But it does require a fairly large telescope to see visually, and you have to know exactly where to look, so it's not exactly an easy observation.
Okay, one final quick question from Ron in Stevensville, Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I had read that the sun is a third-generation star, and I just wanted to know, how the heck does anybody really know that?
Good question, Joel Kastner. Do you want to take a stab at that?
I'll take a stab. Yeah, it comes from the abundances of trace elements that we can detect near the surface of the sun using spectroscopes. You see fairly high abundances of things like iron and oxygen and carbon and a whole bunch of other things whole bunch of other elements that must have been created in previous generations of stars through nuclear fusion. And so that's our best piece of evidence that the sun has formed out of stuff that went through other stars already.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. I'm afraid that's all the time we have time for. Jay McNeil is an amateur astronomer from Paducah, Kentucky, and Joel Kastner is an associate professor of astronomical imaging and spectroscopy at the Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York. Thanks to you both. Earlier, we spoke with Larry Esposito, principal investigator for the Cassini Ultraviolet Imaging Spectrograph, and Jim Bell, associate professor at Cornell University's Department of Astronomy, and Sean Solomon, director of the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism at the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C. Thanks to all of them for joining us today. This program is produced by Annette Heist, Erica Altman, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Bergquist is our director. Our intern is Julie Kalin. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us. Our address is scifry@npr.org. Ira Flato will be back next week. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.